At times, it would eat away at Avrakatos. "It's hard to work without getting any sort of recognition on the outside," he says. "You don't expect to get your name in the papers. You're the little gray men. But it's different with your peer group. It matters. When we had those big ceremonies in the auditorium, Mike never got any recognition, and I never did. No one on the task force ever got any. We were the fucking losers. Black sheep are used to not being recognized. We were used to getting fucked, right? But that's what motivated us, because we were winning and they were losing." There was a moment that fall when Gust thought perhaps he might be taken out of purgatory. Bert Dunn called him at home to see if he would take on a special operation. For the second time in recent memory, there had been a plane disaster, this one directly involving the Central American Task Force chief, Alan Fears, the man Gust had outmaneuvered to get the Afghan job. Dunn said that there had been an incident with a plane that had gone down, and they needed Gust to find out what had happened. It could not have been pleasant for a man like Alan Fears to have Gust Avrakatos with a prosecutor's writ moving into his secret world. For reasons that could not be explained, Fears had dispatched a resupply plane to a destination so far away that the plane's supply of gas would not allow it to make the return trip. Given this simple fact, it was not surprising that the plane had crash-landed inside Nicaragua. It was just pure luck that, unlike the contra-supply plane shot down with ex-CIA agent Eugene Hassenfuss aboard, no one found out about it. Avrakatos was tasked with looking into that one royal screw-up, but it was really a metaphor for a disastrous 6-year operation. As he flew down to Central America, his mind flashed back to his first sense of the disaster brewing for the agency over this divisive covert operation. It had been the same time in January, when he had tried to get George to cut off the Iran madness. There had been a terrible snowstorm, and Gust was at home when Joe Fernandez, one of Alan Fears's station chiefs, called to ask if he could come over. The man said he needed to talk. Avrakatos liked Fernandez. He was a former cop, a good Catholic with 7 children, not one of your Ivy Leaguers, and he was in trouble. Oliver North had asked him to help the Contras build an airstrip in Costa Rica at a time when Congress had made it illegal for the CIA to do anything to help the Contra army. Fernandez had been impressed when North had dropped the president's name, and perhaps overly awed when the Marine Lieutenant Colonel had taken him for a tour of the White House and actually introduced him to the president. North had made him think that everything he asked Fernandez to do came directly from the president. But now Fernandez was being accused of breaking the law, and he was terrified that he would be fired and lose his pension, which would kick in just a few months later. Fernandez knew that Avrakatos had been close to Claire George, and he thought Gust could put in a good word for him. Avrakatos did his best to counsel this man he identified with, and in the end told him the truth as he knew it. Fernandez should not expect any kindness from the director of operations, and Gust was not the man to bring up his case. As he said goodbye to Fernandez that cold winter day, Gust could almost peer into the man's fate. It was the Halloween Day massacre all over again. Fernandez wasn't a blue blood, therefore he was expendable. Sure enough, 2 months before his 50th birthday, Joe Fernandez was fired. At 50, he would have qualified for his pension, but now the agency took the position that it had no responsibility for this man with the 7 kids and the 25 years of service. The agency wasn't there for him when the grand jury handed up the criminal indictments. His boss, Alan Fears, wasn't there for him either. Gust knew that Fernandez didn't understand what was happening to him. He didn't yet understand that his beloved CIA could betray him. Gust did. 11 months later, Avrakatos was stunned at Alan Fears's hopeless foul-up. It was a mind-bending performance from the man who had pompously declared in front of Avrakatos and Casey that the agency's money was being wasted in Afghanistan, that the real victory over communism would begin in Central America, and that Gust's Afghan money should be turned over to him. Now, with the Contra war engulfed in scandal and all but bankrupt, Avrakatos urged Bert Dunn to let him take it. He had credibility on the Hill, and even his past opposition to Iran-Contra could be put to the agency's advantage. Claire George, however, chose once again to banish Avrakatos from the limelight. 6 years later, it wasn't easy for Gust to be charitable, as he watched the news accounts and spoke to his old comrades about George's ordeal. The man the press was calling America's top spy was trapped in federal court in Washington. The CIA wasn't picking up the bills for his 5-count felony prosecution. His lawyer portrayed him as a patriot who had served his country ably and stressed his brave service in Athens under the threat of assassination. But Gust was watching the bottom line. Claire George's own government was now trying to put him in jail, and who should come forward during those proceedings as star witness for the prosecution but Alan Fears? Never before had a case officer breached the code of omerta and snitched on another member of the clandestine services. What made the betrayal so vivid was that Fears was not moved by principle, but was simply attempting to trade the old spymaster for a lighter sentence. Gust didn't badmouth George during those days. He didn't like what the government was doing, and he didn't like what Fears had done. But he felt a grim satisfaction in seeing his prophecy come true. When one of the defense team called to ask if he would testify for Claire, Avrakatos agreed. But I told them if the prosecutor asked me anything about Iran-Contra, Claire would go to jail.